The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS!
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the weeks since the shooting in Parkland, Florida, the push for gun control in this country has gained momentum at an astonishing pace. Students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School pressured Florida lawmakers into passing the first significant gun regulation bill that state has seen in decades. And seemingly overnight, they threw together a national movement known as Never Again, which recently gathered hundreds of thousands of protesters across the country in the event billed as March for Our Lives.
6 minutes and about 20 seconds. In a little over 6 minutes, 17 of our friends were taken from us, 15 were injured, and everyone, absolutely everyone, in the Douglas community was forever altered. Everyone who is there understands.
Emma Gonzalez, a survivor of the Parkland attack, very quickly became one of the most visible leaders of the new movement. She's instantly recognizable. When we see her in public, she's got her army green jacket covered in patches, her head is shaved, her voice is stalwart, and she is absolutely fierce. In the last 2 months, Gonzalez has debated an NRA spokesman on live TV and faced down a wave of trolling attacks from extremists. One video that went viral compared her activism to the Hitler Youth, all of which is a lot to bear for a high school senior who wasn't old enough to vote in the last election. Emma, I barely know where to begin, but what I'd like to know is what your life was like the day before the shootings. What were your days filled with? What were you dreaming of? What did you worry about?
Yeah. So before this all happened, my main concerns were, how can I, like, my shirt doesn't really fit. How can I tailor this better? You know, like, I was very into clothing modifications. I had this old hoodie that my brother had. It was, like, it was an extra large. It was too big for all of the people in the family to wear. So I cut it in half, and then I cut other little strips into it, and I re-sewed the strips so it looks all, like, kind of punk. But not really. It looks cool, and I embroidered a lot of patches onto my patch jacket, which I actually wore at the march because I figured, you know, it's iconic. So, like, mainly watching Netflix was a big.
What do you watch on Netflix?
Oh, what don't I watch on Netflix? I watch a lot of movies. We're a big movie family. We had a whole summer where it was like, now Emma's old enough to watch all the movies that were previously inappropriate. Let's show her everything that now she's old enough to watch. And it was like, it was the summer of Young Frankenstein. It was the summer of Death to Smoochie. It was a good time, you know?
Tell me a little bit about your family.
My family, I have two older brothers. I have two parents. My dad is Cuban. My mom is from Virginia. Mm-hmm. I got my older brothers. One of them is living in New York. He's fully grown. Another is in college ahead of me, and I'm going into college, and I'm very excited about that. We're a very loosey-goosey type of family. Like, our main conversations are just movie quotes.
You know, when people see you behind a microphone or at a demonstration, they look at you and they think this person must have been a very political person, even as a kid, you know, as a teenager. Was that the case?
I would like to think that it was, because especially after the last election, I mean, I was always like understandable of how the way the world works, because in ninth grade, that was when I fully came out. So like, I was very aware of all of the things that could possibly go wrong for someone who is of the LGBT plus community.
Sure. As a political issue, did guns come up among your friends before the shootings?
They did a little bit. We had conversations in class about guns. Like when the Las Vegas shooting happened, we were talking about it in class for, I think, like the whole period. Watching the Las Vegas shooting happen was horrible. That never should have happened. It was definitely something that all of us were like, this is a huge problem. Like, bump stocks are terrible. Why don't they ban them? And then, like, you know, everybody was talking about banning bump stocks, but then they never did. And
Emma, this is a difficult question, I'm sure, but tell me about the way your day began on February 14th. Tell me where you were and when you either heard or saw the first signs of trouble at school.
That was a silver day for me. We have silver days and burgundy days because those are our school colors. And on silver days, I have astronomy, then I have study hall, then I have AP Gov, and then I have English. But during the day, during both lunches, I was doing something for GSA, Gay Straight Alliance. It was a table in the middle of the courtyard where everybody eats lunch. And it was we were handing out proclamations of love because, you know, they're basically like little free Valentine's Day cards that you can give to people. But it looks like an official piece of paper that's like, I proclaim my love to thee, ha ha. And it was a really cute thing. And it was just a way to like spread the love. And some people were like, oh, cool. I love this. I'm going to give this to the person I hate the most and who hates me the most. And I'm like, oh, frenemies. You know, like I didn't really care who took it so long as people were spreading the love. And you could use them if you wanted to like propose to someone and fake marry them. Like it was all good fun and in the name of love. And it was actually kind of funny because later we visited the school on the Sunday after because we had to regroup and someone came up to me and said, hey, Emma, I just wanted you to know that proclamation of love was the last time I got to say I love you to my friend before she died. So wow. So I just want to tell you thank you for giving us that opportunity. And I was thinking about that the day of. I was like, how many people did we sign off those proclamations to, and they were able to give them to their friends before they died? And someone actually came up to me and told me that, and that was wild. But after we finished up the table, I had been sitting out in the sun for about 3 hours straight. So we went to the auditorium and my teacher printed off an attendance sheet to make sure none of us left the auditorium. Because, you know, sometimes we would be able to sneak off and stuff. But this time, for some reason, she doesn't even know why to this day. She just was consumed with the thought like, perfect, I'll print off an attendance sheet. Nobody will be able to ditch the class. And my friend and I were actually going to leave and go to one of our favorite teachers who was on the third floor of the freshman building. And that was one of the classes that got hit pretty hard. And if my teacher hadn't printed off the attendance sheet, we would have been there, which is something to think about.
Emma, it's pretty known that when people in the world lose somebody, they lose friends, they lose relatives, the first period right after, the immediate mourning period, there's a lot to do. There's a lot of commotion. There's friends come over with food. There's the funeral to arrange. There's this, that, and the other thing. That it really sinks in, either the loneliness or the sense of loss comes a bit later. A bit later has now come. We're now in springtime, and this happened in mid-February. I wonder how you and your friends are processing and experiencing the losses that you did now as opposed to 6 weeks ago.
I mean, I don't speak for everybody else in the movement, but I know for a fact that, like, usually nowadays, just the thought of Carmen is enough to overwhelm me.
Tell me about Carmen.
Carmen Shentrup was, she was in the freshman building, and she was killed on that day. And we were good friends. We were on the bus together. We were even on the bus sometimes the same day as the shooter. I knew his bus stop, and hers was, like, right before his. So, feels weird to think about that. And it's not, you know, like, there's always the mix of, oh, it's good to remember those things that are a part of that person's life, but it's also sad to remember that they're not going to continue being that person, that their picture is never going to actually age. It's going to be that picture for the rest of your life, not theirs. But aside from that, it's just mainly like we know that we're pushing for these changes for these people. Us personally, as a part of March for Our Lives, we are connected to the people who are lost in our hometown, so we are fighting for them first and foremost. We are also fighting for those who are lost every day due to this. We have friends now that we know their whole lives have been turned upside down by gun violence. We're fighting for everyone who's been affected by this, but, you know, we all have our own reasons for fighting these battles, and very selfishly, a lot of us in the movement, we pull them first and foremost in our own minds.
Your mother said something amazing about you. She said, this is your mother, Beth, it's like she built herself a pair of wings out of balsa wood and duct tape and jumped off a building, and we're just like running along beneath her with a net, which she doesn't want or think that she needs.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
I remember that line. I think that is kind of true, although I'd like to think, you know, as a mother, she's a little bit more worried about my precarious position than I am, because as a brazen, naive adult, young adult, I'd like to think, I don't have to wear shoes when I'm walking on a paved road. There's no glass here. Stomp, stomp. But, you know, like, I'm very assured in where I am in my life, and I know what is and what isn't from what I've seen, but there are many people who know more about what I don't know because they've seen a lot more and they're older and wiser.
Now, you are right in the center of, and you and your friends are right in the center of a political argument that is, on the one hand, incredibly moving and has moved a lot of people to the streets and into some form of political action or another, but you've had a big taste of how immovable most politicians are, particularly in the Republican Party, but not only, when it comes to guns. What are your real hopes and expectations, and what are your frustrations now that you're encountering real-life politicians in a political battle?
Honestly, encountering those politicians that are very stubborn when it comes to what their beliefs are, what their voting issues are, if they don't reflect what the majority of their constituents are calling for, just makes them that much easier to vote out of office. It's kind of refreshing to see someone who really won't move, because then you can say, well, their opponent will probably move, and then you talk to their opponent and it turns out they will move, and now you know who to vote for or something like that.
But you live in the state of Florida. Are you pretty confident mm-hmm. that on the basis of this issue, somebody like Marco Rubio is going to get voted out?
Yeah, no, we're going to very hopefully vote him out the next presidential election, because he's a disaster. He never listens to anybody. We have a game in my house called Marco Rubio instead of Marco Polo, because, you know, you can't find him because he's never in office. You call him and he's not there. And then you go to his office and he's not there. And you send him a letter and he never answers back. He's just one. That's exactly what should not happen. And the fact that it's a disaster.
Now, you've been attacked in the media and by the NRA pretty hard. And there have been fake photos mm-hmm. of you that have been distributed online. One of them has you, I think, tearing up either the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. I saw.
Yeah, they whitewashed me in that one.
Yeah.
It's funny.
So what's your favorite attack, but how does it overall make you feel?
I don't really know if I have a favorite one. They're all so weak. Like, you know, there's, as far as I know, for me personally, there's been the crisis actor attack that, like, I'm a child actress who shaved her head. But the Constitution one is really funny. Because, like, I don't know, like, it's, they whitewashed me. And they gave me, like, they made my eyes, like, the skin around my eyes look really dark as though I was really tired. Like, that was just funny. And, like, I don't know. They're really weak attacks. I don't think I could actually have a favorite because, like, there'd actually have to be a good one. But they're all really weak.
Emma, I think the march in Washington and the marches that occurred all over the country were among the most moving and important political events in this country in a long time. And then the next day comes. How does the movement mm-hmm. get sustained when inevitably, your classmates are going to begin to separate? Some people are going to get more interested in other things. Political movements are very, very hard to sustain, especially when they're flying in the face of really, really strong opposition. Mm-hmm. How does this go forward?
Well, in terms of people getting pulled apart, I don't really know if that's going to happen here because a tragedy brought us together. And, you know, what happened in Parkland was the beginning of getting everybody to listen. And the march was the beginning of the storytelling. And now we're going around and everybody's going to be directly confronting the people who have the direct say in this. And that would be the representatives. We're going to be doing letter writing campaigns, like Letters for Our Lives and, you know, town halls. We're going to be giving interviews. We're going to be not just us, but the people involved, like people all around the country. Like, I love the kids that we met from Chicago. They're some of the most wonderful people. And we're going to be like lifelong friends, I can tell. It's just they deal with a completely different type of violence almost. You know, they lose 17 people on a good week. It's so important that we get these people's voices heard because they're the people who we should be fighting for the most because they deal with it the most. People wonder how, you know, like they're like, you guys are the generation that has the shortest attention span or whatever. And it's like, well, yeah, but we also know how to keep people's attention on us because we're teenagers and we have the phones.
You have the phones. Mm-hmm. Emma, thank you so much. I thank you for a lot more than just this interview, you and your friends.
Thank you so much.
Emma Gonzalez is a senior at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, in Washington, it seems as if the Trump administration is going to take the hardest line possible with, among other things, Iran. Trump was critical of President Obama's nuclear deal with Iran from the very beginning, But you don't appoint a man like John Bolton, a vocal and very aggressive advocate for preemptive strikes, unless you want to make people very, very nervous. Now, that hard line is being received with absolute joy in Saudi Arabia, which is a bitter enemy of Iran and its chief rival in the Middle East. Staff writer Dexter Filkins has been reporting on Saudi Arabia under its new ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS. MBS represents a huge change in that country. He's young, he's seen as a reformer, and he's working overtime to change the way that Americans think about Saudi Arabia. Dexter Filkins is recently back from Riyadh, and we started out talking about a magazine that we'd found at Walmart, all of its glossy pages dedicated to the greater glory of MBS. So, Dexter, I've got in my hands, before we have a serious conversation about Mohammed bin Salman and Saudi Arabia, I've got this publication, this magazine, that sells for a mere $13.99 on the newsstand called The New Kingdom. And apparently, this is a publication put out by the folks at American Media, the people who do the National Enquirer and much else. What is this? Look at this.
Yeah, it looks like a superhero comic book. Boy King transforms the universe. And there's this very flattering photo of him. And at the bottom of every page, it says The Magic Kingdom, which I guess is referring to—
It's a little Disney-ish
now. To the Magic Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
What's amazing as I flip through this magazine is that there are just beautiful pictures of, you know, windmills and falconry and women getting together. It's like a fantasy of what Saudi Arabia is or could be.
Well, I think they're trying to sell MBS as the savior of Saudi Arabia, and this is what the kingdom could be. And as many people put it to me, this guy's going to be king for 50 years, and this is the Saudi Arabia that he wants. And so he's kind of turning the big aircraft carrier in another direction.
So MBS is just in the United States, and he met a tremendous number of people, whether they're in politics or business, and it clearly is a huge diplomatic and PR effort going on. Who is MBS, and why is he different from the King of Saudi Arabia and his predecessors?
Well, he's the crown prince, so he's the next in line to become king. And as somebody put it to me, an American diplomat, we're used to, you know, when we get on the phone with the King of Saudi Arabia, he's 85 years old and he's kind of half asleep and he mumbles a lot. And then the phone call's over. And this guy talks, you know, he's engaged.
He's 32 years old.
He's 32 years old. He's ambitious. He's impatient. He's charming. He's charismatic. He's tall. He's on the make.
So even as crown prince, MBS has been making some liberalizing moves. He's promised to overhaul the Saudi economy. He's lifted restrictions, including women driving. Is he offering real reform?
Yes, but it's important to distinguish what kind of reforms. It definitely wants to open up the economy. There's a lot of economic reforms that he's initiated. He's trying to restrain the clergy. He's letting women drive. The one thing that's not on the table is political reform. This is all about saving the House of Saud.
And maintaining power. So what is the economic predicament of Saudi Arabia?
It's pretty dire.
We think of them as just magnificently wealthy.
And they are. But they're burning cash at an extraordinary rate. And it's a vast welfare state where almost everything is subsidized from food to gasoline to education to healthcare, housing. But what's happening is that the whole economy was built on the idea that oil would be about $100 a barrel. It's about 60 right now. And so they're just basically burning through their savings. And so as somebody put it to me in the story, at current trends, in 5 to 7 years, Saudi Arabia is broke. They're running out of money.
Unless they do what? Because I don't expect that in 5 to 7 years, the petro economy will disappear.
It won't disappear, but they can't sustain what they have. They don't export anything else. They import virtually everything else. So they've got to diversify. They got to do something else.
Now, MBS has also talked about inspiring a Saudi entertainment industry. I don't normally think of Riyadh as a kind of proto-Hollywood or New York or Paris in that way.
It's amazing. He's doing it. Movie theaters, concerts, you know, with certain restraints, but he's doing it.
So Tom Friedman at the New York Times came back from doing an interview with MBS in Riyadh, and he wrote an extremely enthusiastic column, said he was rooting for him. And he got some pushback for this on human rights, on any number of issues. And Friedman appeared at the Brookings Institute, and he'd been asked whether he had been kind of foolhardy to be too optimistic about MBS's rule. And here was Friedman's response.
I got news for you. The entire Arab world is dysfunctional right now. And so when I see someone having the balls to take on the religious component of that, to take on the economic component, to take on the political, with all of his flaws, okay, that I want to invest just a little. I just want to stick my head up and say, God, I hope you succeed. And when you do that, the holy hell comes down on you. Okay, well, fuck that. Okay, is my view. Okay, so.
What do you think? Do you agree with Friedman?
Yes and no. I mean, he's right about, okay, we got somebody in here who wants to, like, change it up. And all power to him. I think the problem with that kind of unbridled enthusiasm is it ignores the kind of darker side of what's happening.
Well, let's get into the darker side of what's happening. Where are the main areas?
So, in addition to all these things that he's done, at the very same time, he's arrested human rights leaders. He's detained journalists.
There's not going to be freedom of speech.
Absolutely not. I mean, that's just off the table, and in many ways he's tougher than his predecessor. So he's clamping down on any kind of notion of political reform at the same time. And then of course we have the famous now wave of arrests when he dragged in dozens of very wealthy Saudis, even some of his relatives.
But he put them in that well-known prison, the Ritz-Carlton, which was
yes.
A very peculiar thing, no?
Very peculiar. I mean, the you know, it's a hotel for princes. It's just not generally for princes under arrest.
And maybe the main thing that happened at the Ritz-Carlton is that MBS forced any number of these people to give up either all of their assets or billions of dollars, tremendous amounts of assets, all in the name of anti-corruption. How is that done and toward what political end?
Well, you know, some of these were the richest people in the world. We're suddenly locked up in the Ritz-Carlton. And so as best we understand it, when they were sitting in their hotel rooms from which the doors had been removed and anything that could be used to harm themselves, they were interrogated and their financial documents were kind of laid out in front of them. And they negotiated and arrived at a figure. And it usually, as I understand it, wasn't all of their money. It was some of it. So you're worth $2 billion, we get $1 billion. And so it was kind of agreed to, and then you signed that away. Everybody kind of shook hands, and then no one spoke about it when they came out. They didn't want anything really bad to happen to them.
Did anything bad happen to them?
Looks like it.
What
looks
happened?
Like it. There's at least one person who died in custody, it looks like under pretty grim circumstances. But at the end of the day, MBS got $100 billion from in the big shakedown.
The Saudi government got $100 billion from it. Wow. Your piece seems to imply that MBS has been making deals with the United States, and the Trumps are pleased to be making these deals for two reasons. One for geopolitical reasons, and the other is for potentially for personal reasons, so this is more difficult to ferret out.
Yes.
Let's start with geopolitical. In the Obama administration attempted to create a kind of detente or better to say a balance of powers in the region by dealing with Iran, signing a nuclear deal, dealing with it in all the complexity that you have to deal with Iran. Now you have the Trump administration, which sees a pure friend in Saudi Arabia and a pure enemy in Iran.
That's exactly what happened. I mean, the Trump administration came in and said, this whole thing about sharing the neighborhood, which is what Obama said to the Saudis, share it. We're tearing that up. And we're going to go after Iran. And so, you know, the Iranians have essentially come to dominate, as they see it, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. They're everywhere. They're on the march. And we are going to roll them back. And I heard that phrase many times talking to people in the Trump administration, roll back the Iranians. And so in the past year, what have we seen? the Saudis and the Emiratis essentially tried to overthrow the government in Qatar. They think Qatar is too close to Iran. They tried to essentially overthrow the government in Lebanon. And then they launched this, you know, enormous and very bloody bombing campaign in Yemen, intervening in the civil war there because they see the Iranians as essentially behind
it. Which the United States assists in.
Yes, I mean
on the Saudi side.
Yeah, I mean the Obama White House kind of held their nose and said, "Okay, we'll keep sending you the bombs to drop," but they really didn't like it. And the Trump administration said, "Just you know, go to it."
Dexter, you've explained the geopolitical reasons why the Trumps are going to be close to MBS and have been. There's also the personal aspect, the personal financial aspect to it. How would you break that down?
Well, this is complicated, but both the Trump and the Kushner families have financial interests in the Middle East.
So Qatar, which is home to a key American airbase, is currently the target of a blockade. Probably not by coincidence, but you tell me. Your reporting turned up evidence of a failed real estate deal between the Qataris and the Kushner family. What happened? And it seems to be a factor in the administration's attitude toward the blockade of Qatar.
It's all this is just remarkable. I'm shaking my head. The Kushner Companies owns the big high rise
666 Fifth Avenue,
and with that has a mortgage of $1 billion, more than $1 billion that's coming due soon. As I was told by a very credible source in the financial industry, the Kushner Companies in April 2017 came to the Qataris in the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan.
Looking for cash.
Looking for $1 billion. They asked for $1 billion.
As one does.
Yeah, as one does. They had a big plan to kind of renovate the building and kind of make it all work. And the Qataris, they have a sovereign wealth fund with $300 billion in it. They have money to burn. They looked at the deal that Kushner had kind of laid out for them, Charles Kushner, Jared's father, and said, you know, forget it. Thanks very much, but no thanks. 6 weeks later, there's a blockade announced on Qatar.
John Bolton's going to be National Security Advisor very soon. How do his priorities and records square with MBS?
This is going to be a very unpredictable period. I think John Bolton is on. I think he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times a few years ago, essentially calling for preemptive strikes against Iran. That's just exactly the sort of thing that MBS is thinking.
MBS compares the Iranian leadership to Hitler.
Yes. I had these conversations when I was in Riyadh. They said it's the Nazi ideology. And they do not merely want to dominate the Gulf. They want to destroy Saudi Arabia and conquer Saudi Arabia. And we are – it's no more Mr. Nice Guy. And so instead of what you had, I think, in the Obama administration was they were essentially restraining the Saudis from getting into some kind of serious, maybe a shooting match with the Iranians in the Gulf. Now it's a completely different ballgame. I mean now essentially – I think with Bolton and even to a certain extent with Mike Pompeo, the new Secretary of State, they're going to be going after the Iranians.
Do you think the Iranian nuclear deal is done?
Maybe. My sense is they want the Iranians to cry uncle. I mean, they're looking for a reason to back away from it.
Dexter, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
That was Dexter Filkins, a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can find his piece on MBS, the Saudi leader Mohammed bin Salman, and everything Dexter has written for us at newyorker.com. Nomi Fry is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and she's our pop culture correspondent. She writes about internet news and gossip columns and much else. And I trust her to lead me to things that I just might not find otherwise. Nomi just wrote a piece called The Great Sadness of Ben Affleck, and it stirred the internet into a days-long frenzy.
Hello.
Poor Ben Affleck.
Yeah. I'm talking about Ben Affleck, in
Ben.
Fact. I feel a sympathy towards Ben, and I was more sort of
trying to sort of recount how the internet, in fact, has treated him. And I thought...
When you speak of the internet, it's almost as if you're speaking of this living, breathing, 48-eyed, 19-eared monster.
I mean, it's a bit like that, I guess. Yeah.
Do you have anything to suggest?
Yes, I do. I have several things. So the first thing is the show Big Mouth, which was on Netflix.
Tell me a little bit about the show.
So it's an animated show, and it's about puberty.
Oh, God, that sounds like hell on wheels.
Who are just, yes, yeah, so that moment, that hellish moment is being explored in ways that are both really vulgar and really sensitive and touching.
So, how do you two know Roland? Are you dating her?
Andrew?
I only ask because I know Nick, you know, likes her.
Andrew.
Or, I'm sorry, are you two dating each other, like, as gays? Or maybe you're just people?
Andrew, please, shut the fuck up.
Ah, yes, Mr. Boring, you are my next art installation.
And I would say that it's the best show about teens or tweens, I guess just teens.
That's the point.
Since Freaks and Geeks.
I'm hooked already.
I know. It's incredible. It's really incredible. And I want to urge anyone who hasn't watched this amazing show to do so.
Right away.
Right away. Just stop listening.
But when they finish watching the show, what should they do next?
Okay. So the next thing I have, this is a series of videos that started the magazine Complex.
Mm-hmm.
They do this recurring, it's like once a month. It's called Sneaker Shopping. And it's usually like athletes or rappers or like reality stars or models. And I am a pretty late adopter to this. Like a lot of other people, I probably only learned about this when this was in October of 2017. Bella Hadid goes sneaker shopping. As you can see, it has almost 4.5 million views.
These are coming home with me. You're gonna put these with the black dress, you're gonna look sexy as shit. So you're gonna kill it. Slip-ons over there.
And Bella Hadid, for those of us who don't know, is a supermodel, and she also has a deal with Nike. She also is like showing her commitment to the brand.
What's different about these videos as opposed to some other kind of, you know, taste-making videos?
Well, I think it's very interesting because we're being sort of invited to view these videos as a place where we'll see what's cool and like what's the most now thing. But what's revealed is this kind of incredible awkwardness often. There's something about what the people do or don't do with their hands, their attempts to explain something that they feel sort of interested in, but maybe not totally passionate about,
right,
like sneakers. That just makes for a very like avant-garde, almost like a kabuki theater kind of feel, which is something very odd to find in like a video about sneakers and shopping where you tally up like the bill at the end and leave with like bags full of loot.
What's next?
Okay, so the next thing I have, go on Instagram and check out the feed, the account Shia's Outfits. This is a person, I believe he's out of Philadelphia. It's not his personal account. He created it about a year ago. And he basically just posts pictures of the actor Shia LaBeouf and his street style. So he gets photographed a lot, obviously.
We're talking jeans and cargo shorts here.
Well,
We're looking at it here. We're leafing through.
Yeah.
It's a little on the street smooching, kind of right out of Us Weekly.
So here he's wearing Crocs and socks.
Is that considered a fashion mistake?
It's considered, I think by most it would be considered a fashion don't. Maybe now that he's done it, maybe people will be like, oh, Crocs, it's actually cool.
And in fairness, the Crocs themselves are the color of what used to be called in popsicle world sky blue.
So yeah, so Shia looks a bit like a schlub, you know, to the untrained eye. But in fact, you know, he's very much appreciated as an icon in the kind of the world of streetwear. And it's because of these little twists that he does. It's like he weirdly like tucks his pants inside his socks and it looks like bulky and weird. But then you look at it again and you're like, this is actually like kind of a cool silhouette. Or he tucks his sweatshirt inside his shorts. Like,
whoa,
who does that?
No,
but
can't
I'm telling
be doing
you.
That.
No, but that's the thing. It looks great. Yes.
If I do it?
you know, no. Try it. We just come into the office one day and I'll tell you.
You're on. You're absolutely on.
Incredible.
Nomi Fry, staff writer at The New Yorker. And coming up, we'll hear the voice behind some of the most beloved of the Muppet characters.
Animal!
That's his name, actually. Yes, okay, well, I guess your drums mean a great deal to you, huh?
Yeah!
That's coming in a minute on The New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
There's a pretty good chance you know the name Frank Oz. If you don't, I guarantee you know his voice. Frank Oz was a teenager when he started working with Jim Henson, the creator of the Muppets. Oz went on to create characters like Bert, of Ernie and Bert, Cookie Monster, Miss Piggy, and if you're not impressed yet, he did Yoda.
So certain are you?
Master, moving stones around is one thing. This is totally different.
No different. Only different in your mind.
Frank Oz went on to direct his own films with full-sized adult people, comedies like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Little Shop of Horrors, and Bowfinger. His latest is a documentary that he made with some of his former colleagues from the Henson Shop. It's called Muppet Guys Talking, which is probably pretty self-explanatory. The New Yorker's foremost authority on all things Muppet is Michael Shulman. Recently, Michael paid Frank Oz a visit, and he brought along one of his most prized possessions, a lunchbox.
How's your lunchbox?
I brought it. Just me. I'm so happy. Wait. I did bring this. So, last time we met, I gave it to you to sign. I just thought you were going to write Frank Oz on it, but you took it away for a couple minutes, got a Sharpie, and when you gave it back to me, it was just so... I got a full-on shudder through my entire body because, so you signed to Michael from Frank Oz, and then on Fozzie, on top of Fozzie, you signed as Fozzie with this special signature with a little hat over the eye, and then turned it around. Miss Piggy has her own signature, which is kind of dainty and girly, and then Animal on the back has his own signature in character, which is completely crazy and unhinged. And it made me think about how deeply you know these characters, that each of them actually has their own signature. I mean, how did just the signatures develop?
Yeah, all of us do that. Jim had his own signatures for all the characters, for Kermit, for Dr. Teeth, for everybody. And I think it just kind of happens organically. We don't really plan anything. Once you do know your character, eventually you start getting not only a signature, but a voice, because the voice just comes much later, you know.
And one thing I'm so fascinated by is the sort of psychological profiles you have of these characters, who I think people who don't really appreciate the depth of the Muppets and the art that you guys all brought to it would see them as sort of simplistic characters, but they really have so much going on beneath the surface that makes them real.
You have not been honest with me, Kermit.
I haven't?
No. When you told me we were spending a week in the swamp, you never said there would be snakes and spiders and alligators.
Well, no, I was saving the best part for a surprise.
Surprise? Kermit, you are out of your little green mind.
Can we start with Miss Piggy and just, sure. Can you tell me a little bit about how she was shaped as a character?
Yeah, it's not an intellectual exercise. I don't know if anybody else does it, but I have biographies of most of my characters, not all of them, I mean, even Yoda. And with Piggy, it came about, and she grew, I mean, my feeling, and I'll give you a shortened version of it, she grew up on a farm, and her father, who absolutely loved her, died in a tractor accident. Her mother then started getting suitors, and as Piggy grew up, the suitors started getting more interested in Piggy than the mother, and that caused tremendous tension, and so Piggy had to leave. She made some money doing some things that she was not very proud of. And
what?
Yeah, she would do like a
her
bacon
sorted days?
Bacon commercial.
Oh God.
And then she once she got the money, she went to charm school and learned how to be a lady. Because if she was just herself, she was too strong for men, and men don't necessarily like strong women. And so she had to play coy, 1950s coy, while underneath it, she's really a tough pig, a tough woman. It goes on and on like that.
I'm honestly so obsessed with this. I could hear the long version. I could hear the day-long version.
But again, it makes no difference from anybody else. It's important for me to know. So I can have a full idea of a character. And if I didn't know that, then I believe you guys wouldn't believe it.
So you also did Animal. And I can't imagine that Animal has as deep a psychology as some of these other ones. How do you summarize Animal?
I think there's no way in God's earth Freud could penetrate Animal. There is no psychology whatsoever in Animal. There's just sensuousness and appetite and desire.
In the documentary, you say there are five words that define him, I think.
Five words that define Animal.
Drums is one of them.
It's drums, food, sleep, sex, and pain. That's Animal. That's all it is.
Real?
Oh, absolutely. Not that he would ever have sex. He's heard about it somewhere. And so he's got to experience everything he's never had. But nevertheless, who would go with him? By the way, who would?
That question I cannot answer.
But that is Animal. So all these characters, none of this is known to the public now. I guess it is, but it's only known to me in order for me to believe them more. So you guys believe them,
right? You know. So I want to talk about Jim Henson a little bit, because I really think of you and Henson as one of the great creative duos of the last century, up there with...
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I really think of you and Jim as one of the great creative duos.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I really think of you and Jim Henson...
You totally bought that, didn't you?
It's going to get
totally
even better if you let me finish. Should I say that again?
I'm
more
sorry,
times?
I just couldn't hear
five
you.
Five more times? Lennon and McCartney.
That was very kind of you. I'm sorry. I had to go for it. It was cheap. I admit that. I totally admit it.
it was cheap, but I fell for it.
But thank you very much.
So what was a typical day working on The Muppet Show like?
Well, on the Muppet Show in particular, the days were this. It was... We had weekends off, except Jim didn't, because Jim would be editing the previous week's work. Jim worked harder than anybody else. Monday, we would get together with the guest star of the week, and the guest star who, if they had musical numbers, I remember right across from me when Ethel Mermer was on, and there were no puppets there, but just we were doing... the bit, and she was singing like 6 inches from me, not a foot from me, there's no business like show. It was wow. Incredible. But we didn't have puppets on at that time. That was a musical rehearsal around the piano. And then we would all take our tape recorders out, our guys, and prepare for the next day, which would be band day. What we would do is then we would get individual tracks. So I would get individual track of the drums. Dave would get tracks of the saxophone for Zoot. Richard Hunt would get the individual track of Janis for the guitar. And Jim would get the individual track of the keyboards. So we prided ourselves on that night working like crazy to make sure we weren't just screwing around, but we actually hit those notes.
Wow. And this is for the fabulous Muppet House band, the Electric Mayhem.
Yeah.
Who was my favorite band growing up.
That's great. and then we would, that band day was one pretty long day. And then the next day we'd start shooting and we'd have 3 days to shoot the show. And then we'd start all over again the following week.
And what was the creative atmosphere that allowed all of you to create that kind of chaos?
That was Jim. That was the safety of knowing that Jim wanted us to try anything. And if we failed, no one's in trouble. If we failed, no one's going to get fired. If we failed, no one's going to be demoted. No one's going to be yelled at. He just wanted to push the envelope on everything. I mean, look at Dark Crystal and Labyrinth and everything else. And Storyteller on TV, some of the best TV I've ever seen. He just wanted to always push the envelope, and that included us. So we're allowed to push the envelope and totally screw up. But he said it was okay. Let's just play.
Mm-hmm. The technical aspects of shooting the Muppets are always so interesting. And you hear about these incredible lengths that you would all have to go to, like, you know, at the beginning of the Muppet movie when Kermit's singing in the swamp, the Rainbow Connection, and Jim had to be in an underwater tank with his mm-hmm. arm up all day.
Yeah.
The bicycle riding scene in the Great Muppet Caper, I understand, was just a huge technical challenge that Jim wanted to do. What was the hardest thing that you remember doing as a Muppet performer on a technical level?
You know, it was all hard, and that's what we enjoyed, and that was the joy of it, to do the hard stuff, because that's what Jim liked to do. So it was all hard. I mean, I guess when I was underwater, and again, Jim did The Impossible, when Piggy was underwater.
In The Great Muppet Caper.
In The Muppet Caper.
The synchronized swimming number. Yeah. That's one of the all-time great Muppet songs.
I had to work Piggy, and she was brought out to me by a rowboat, because you had to put Piggy on my arm while I was under the water. And as I said, the speakers were there so I could hear the music. There was also underwater monitors I could look at the performance. I also had to put both of my feet in kind of loops around bricks so my body could stay down so it wouldn't float up. And then there was a scuba diver next to me with an air hose. And so I would be breathing in the air hose. And then Jim would, our first AD would say, okay, ready? And I'd spit out the air hose and we'd start the take. And I'd do the take for as long as it took. And then I'd say, okay, and cut. And then the scuba diver would bring the air hose back to me. And that went on for about a week.
Oh my goodness. Well,
but it was all worth it.
That's one of my all-time favorites, Piggy's Fantasy from The Great Muppet Caper. I love it.
It's just, people say it's hard, but this was part of the territory. We didn't think it was hard. We thought it was normal because Jim thought it was normal.
So in 1991, of course, Jim very tragically passed away of an infection, and it was a loss to, you know, the children of the world and his company and his family, but also very specifically to you as his creative partner and friend. And I'm wondering, how did you react to that as an artist? Did you have to sort of rethink what your role as a creative person was now being without that very close partnership?
I never thought about it. Also, when you mentioned it was important to the children of the world, actually, half the people who saw the Muppet Show were adults. And so people talk about the children, but the truth is it was really so much the adults and the children, not only one or the other, because Jim was never a children's performer. I was never a children's performer. We just did what we did as adults, and then adults and children either liked it or didn't, you know. But I never been asked that, Michael, before, about reassessing creatively after Jim died. You know, it was, you know, I think it took a long time for any of us to work with Jim's characters when somebody else was doing Jim. So I think the period of grief was long enough that that could be done. It was never the same. It was never the same chemistry. But I never had to actually reassess. There was a sense of loss of this chemistry that we had. Other than that, I didn't reassess. I just had to go forward.
Mm-hmm. So the Muppets are now owned by Disney, and they've been back in the last couple of years doing new movies, a TV show on ABC that was short-lived. When you see the Muppets now functioning under the Disney corporate umbrella, I mean, what do you see in terms of the Henson legacy being carried on or not? Is it the same?
No, it's not the same. I mean, I don't slam Disney because I know they really love the characters. And first of all, there's one person in particular who, Debbie McClellan, who works at Disney, and she's absolutely fantastic, and she's the best. But, you know, today's Muppets, I feel the music has always been so important, and I don't sense much music with Muppets. I think even our guys who are doing it are fantastic, but the writing of it, I don't sense that rebelliousness, that anarchy, and affection, you know, and that's what it was about, that what I call affectionate anarchy with the Muppets that Jim really taught us without teaching us. And so I've not been asked for help, and so I'm not, you know, there was a movie I wrote with Jim Lewis, and they decided to go with another movie Jason Siegel did. And so their view is a different view of Muppets than I have.
If you were consulted, what advice would you give them? What's the sort of special sauce that you think
they need? Say listen to the puppeteers more. Let them lead. They know what they're doing.
So you've played all these characters who, you know, from Yoda to Miss Piggy to Fozzie, who are so lodged deep in people's subconscious. I mean, at this point, anyone under 50, and that includes me, you know, who grew up with a television on, knows these voices, these characters, which are aspects of you. I'm wondering, what is that like for you just moving through the world? Do you have these weird experiences with people where they feel like...
Yeah, it's not weird. It's quite touching. I mean, with Muppet Guys, this has happened so many times, but with Muppet Guys talking, when we were at the South by Southwest Film Festival, which is really great, I remember somebody coming up to me and couldn't even speak. She was just sobbing and said, you know, Fozzie's my hero because I'm dyslexic, but Fozzie never gave up, so I didn't give up, and I became valedictorian. I mean, well, how do you grasp that? Those kind of things happen all the time. On Twitter, I have gotten several tweets from people saying, you know, I was an abused child, or I was lonely all my time as a child, or whatever. And the Muppets were my only friends, the only people who I could relate to. You know, those Muppet characters, they are not normal. None of them are. Even Kermit. But Kermit's as normal as you can be. And so you have all these different species living together who have their own inner conflicts, their own problems, exactly like us, and yet they get along. And I can understand how people can feel comfortable in that because that's kind of who we are. We're not perfect, and yet, you know, it doesn't mean just because you're not perfect, just because you have a problem, it doesn't mean you're not valuable, you know?
Absolutely.
Frank Oz, one of the founding members of the Muppet team, talking with The New Yorker's Muppet correspondent, Michael Shulman. And if you're a fan, you can find the documentary Muppet Guys Talking on the internet. And that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. I bet you had no idea we were on Twitter, but you know what? We are at New Yorker Radio. So stay in touch, and we'll see you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Toon Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Calla Leah, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Tarina Endowment Fund.